Now, with me in studio this morning are Mary Whelan, former ambassador to Austria in the Netherlands and permanent rep of UN agencies and WTO, Ken Murphy, DG of the Law Society, Kieran Hancock, business editor of the Irish Times, Fergus Findlay, former CEO of Barnardo's, and Amy McKeever, editor of Irish Country Living. And you are all very, very welcome indeed. I think I'll start with the Maria Bailey story. This gets coverage in a number of papers about the fact that there has a report been compiled and it may not be published. Ken Murphy. Oh, I didn't introduce my guests. Oh, I did. Ken Murphy. On that one.
Yeah, the Maria Bailey, the report, which has been senior counsel Kennedy has been asked by the Taoiseach to investigate what actually happened in relation to Maria Bailey and her personal injuries claim and the controversy that's surrounding it. The main controversy at the moment is whether or not this report will ever be published. And it seems the Taoiseach's intention is that it won't. I think that's perfectly, you can view it as a private matter in terms of a private individual, his own party, but he's going to find it very difficult to sustain that politically, I think. So we don't know what the contents of the report are.
Do you think there's a validity? Because to a galloping horse there could be, that if people who were spoken to or who were asked to speak were told that if they did so it would be in confidence, that then you can't just go and publish it.
You can take that view as a matter of law, but we're talking really about this as a matter of politics rather than about law.
Yeah.
And as we know, politics has different rules. So I would wonder if that's going to be a sustainable position or whether some form of redacted version of the report may ultimately be published, because the heat was taken out of this politically a number of weeks ago when the decision was, it's good, you know, send it off and have an inquiry.
Down the road,
the temperature dropped. But the temperature will rise again because people want to know what went on here.
And Kieran?
What degree of complaint the public may have about it.
Yeah, I mean, there's an editorial in the Sunday Business Post today calling for Leo Varadkar to publish the report and not to hide behind it. I mean, if you think, who are the various parties involved in this report? We're told that David Kennedy said to them that he wouldn't publish, or based on the interviews, the report wouldn't be published. Well, we have Maria Bailey, who's already done an extensive interview on Sean O'Rourke. So we have a lot of detail from that side. We have Press Up, who I don't think have anything to...
Owners.
The owners of the Dean Hotel where she fell off the swing. And I don't... I mean, my sense is I interviewed Matt Ryan a couple of weeks ago, who's one of the co-owners of Press Up, and he didn't want to go into this specific area because of the report. And he said, let's wait and see. His understanding was that the report was going to be published, and he said he might be able to talk about it after then. So I don't see why Press Up wouldn't want to talk about it, because it actually it went quite well for them when you think about it.
Yeah, can I ask you a question? Did you ask him, or did he say to you, why would you put a swing in a pub?
Very often people
get inebriated in a pub, and it's not when you would recommend getting up on a swing.
Yeah. Well, actually, the swings remain in place. Even, you know, whatever about putting them there in the first place, they've left them there. And he said to me that the swings are enjoyed and photographed by so many people who visit the hotel that we're not going to remove them from the fray because the likes of Maria Bailey are intent of doing what she did. And he said, if you were to do that, then you might have to take the doors off the toilets
for the woman who might get their finger jammed.
I'm sure every visitor wants to see the swing now, I'm sure.
Well, absolutely. It's a great talking point.
The best publicity that they ever got.
It's a great talking point for them now. But they've left them in place. Anyway, I think they might have lowered them a bit more towards the floor.
Are there instructions, I wonder?
Yeah, they were taken away for
a while. Well, there were pictures on social media of the swing, and I don't actually know how you could swing. First of all, they're about 3 inches above the ground, and secondly, they're right up against the wall. So you're never going to get a decent go off it. The whole, as a kind of bit of interior decor, it never made sense to me. But like this report, I'm frankly puzzled by it because I think we all know everything we needed to know about this incident, with the exception of the answers to two questions. And I can't think of any reason why an independent reporter with legal qualifications couldn't, even if he can't publish the whole report, he couldn't give us his answers to those two questions. Was the claim justified? did Maria Bailey knowingly make any dishonest assertions? That's all we need to know.
I think another question that Fine Gael wanted to know was who revealed what was in her submission just coming up to an
that's
election.
That's of no interest to the wider public, is it?
They'd be fascinated.
Oh, right. We're always fascinated to know who leaked what to whom.
Yes, yeah.
But it doesn't solve any problems. I mean, the key issue, if there's an issue of public interest in this, and, you know, there's a side of me that feels really sorry for Maria Bailey, because for the rest of her life...
Yeah.
Long after people have forgotten whether this was a scandal or not a scandal or what the hell it was, they're going to be talking and joking and laughing about mm-hmm. the swing. Mm-hmm. And that's, she's saddled with that, so yeah. to speak. Can you be saddled with the swing? I don't know. Mm.
Let me think about that. You probably put the saddle on the swing.
The public interest
anyway.
Arises from the connection with the other story that we're going to be talking about, which is the, you know, insurance industry and the mad premiums and so on. And we do need to know whether... in the eyes of an independent person, any dishonesty or impropriety was conducted in relation to that claim.
Mary?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that the reason this was a story in the first place was that there seemed to be a disconnect between the government's position on exorbitant claims and the actions of somebody who was a TD in the government party. I thought that was the public interest. Mm. And it's very difficult to see how an independent investigation can really adjudicate on that. We have laws, we have courts to adjudicate on whether she had a claim, whether she didn't have a claim. So I think this is a made-up issue, but the real issue...
politically, you see, it all emerged the week before the election.
Local election. Mm-hmm. And we all remember that. And I think it undoubtedly has damaged her. Whether it's damaged the government, I don't know. But I do think it may be, and hopefully a good thing would be, that we see more action on these ridiculous insurance claims.
Right. Well,
and I'm saying that without saying hers was ridiculous.
Yeah, because we don't know.
We don't know.
Yeah. Okay, well then, moving on. There's something else that we sort of don't know about, and yet, do we? And this is the case of Lisa Smith. And I think people are very puzzled. And parts of her interview that she did with the BBC are jaw-dropping, really, when she talks about, you know, the attacks on the Yazidi and the slavery and all that, which is very well documented, and said you would need to see both sides. She also said on beheadings she would need to hear both sides. Very, very hard to take all that seriously. But anyway, a female fighter filmed in the area of ISIS bride Lisa Smith. That's in the Sunday Times page 4. And the Sunday World has a story headed, "Father says his girl wouldn't hurt a fly." I come to you on those, Ken. I'll start with you again on that. I so happened to get a book for Christmas called The Beekeeper of mm-hmm. Sinjar, mm-hmm. which is a series of stories of the savagery mm-hmm. visited on those Yazidi women, some of whom who can't go back home because they've had children and all of that thing. Slavery, they were judged by smell from these guys mm-hmm. that bought them. I mean, just atrocious. Hard to know that people don't know that the Yazidi women were treated mm. wrongly.
It's hard to have much belief in the credibility of what Ms. Smith is saying, really, in terms of her... there's an extent to which she seems to be in denial. Maybe she's still in some form of trauma or thrall to all of this. But it just doesn't accord... it seemed to accord with reality. She seems to have relatively few regrets about anything she saw or witnessed out there, and since most of us are appalled by the reports we've heard of it, that raises question marks about her and her attitude.
Yeah.
I see she talks about, you know, she has some regret that the caliphate didn't turn out to be exactly as she hoped it would be, but she doesn't seem to regret pursuit of this type of life, the real question, I suppose, from an Irish point of view is, is she coming back? And the story in yesterday's paper was that the differing branches of intelligence, the Gardaí and the military here, were debating that and maybe even receiving different views in relation to it. She has a small child, a two-year-old child. She's perfectly entitled to come back, as far as I'm concerned, in my opinion.
We have dealt with difficult... I'm not saying she's guilty of any killing or that she said she wasn't, but, I mean, our other citizens the IRA,
I don't think there's any substance to a suggestion that she's some sort of security risk to the state. I don't think of anything of that kind. It's just that her attitudes don't seem, given the way in which the world now sees the appalling human rights violations that took place and were central to that whole world that she was part of, she doesn't seem to be displaying much by way of regret or remorse about any of that.
Okay, Amy, you were reading in the Sunday World, dad.
Yeah, so the father has come out on this saying his daughter wouldn't hurt a fly and that she's not a danger, similar to what Ken is saying. But I think that I would agree, it's her own commentary that's the issue. And there's another piece, actually, a related piece in the Sunday Independent on page 16 about exactly what you were saying, Marion. She won't even know her mother loved her very much. The children born of the Yazidi women enslaved by ISIL have nowhere to go. I find it highly unlikely that she didn't know if this was going on, but I would have sympathy for the fact that she does have a two-year-old child who is innocent and is an Irish citizen. And I think that in terms of what the Irish government should do, the two-year-old would be my priority. In terms of what's happening to the children out there, that we do need to have some level of protection for the child, the two-year-old that's an innocent party in all
right.
this.
Well, and as we say, we can't say anything specific because we don't know about Lisa Smith, but we do know she's an Irish citizen, and we do know that we deal with her as an Irish citizen, and that's just simply that, Ciarán.
Yeah, I'd say this is one problem that Leo Varadkar never envisaged having to deal with, and it's a real headache for the government, as to whether they repatriate her or not, and then if she is repatriated, what do you do?
If she wanted to come home, if she could, if she could get out of where she is, of course she can come home. She hasn't committed any crime or anything like that. Well, the question is, do we send in troops to get her out?
We're not sending troops anyway, by the looks of things.
But Declan Power, who's a security and defence analyst, and he's on the airwaves in RTÉ quite a bit, he's urged the government to establish a team of Garda and military personnel to devise the best course of action. And he says that if she is repatriated, basically she should be charged for supporting ISIS, that this was a violent terrorist group which engaged in horrific activities. This is a quote he's given to John Mooney in today's Sunday Times. So it raises that issue. I'm not sure if there's any legal basis for that, but it's certainly a headache for the government.
Mary Whelan. Oh, sorry, I'll come to you, Fergus, in a second. Mary, since you've got that involvement as well, the UN-wide.
Well, I mean, on one hand, you could easily say she got herself there, she should get herself back. But I think that's to treat her differently than we would any other Irish citizen in distress. We don't ask that our citizens agree with everything we do. We don't even ask that they're always law-abiding to offer them consular assistance. And I think that there are two Irish citizens there who should be treated the same as any other Irish citizen. And in that context, I would prioritise the child.
Right.
Are they safe in the camp? Is there a threat to their life? If there is, then it should move up the list of priorities. If they are not in danger, if there is no, if they are living there with maybe the minimum, but they are living there in safety, I do think we should look at finding a way without putting anyone else's life in danger of repatriating them to Ireland.
Yeah, but I mean, there was talk of sending in the Gardaí, sending in, I don't know, foreign affairs representatives, talk of the Americans getting involved and delivering her to the Jordanian border. Do you think we should do all that?
I've no doubt that the government, I would imagine that the government is looking at what are the various things that could be done. Let me put this in a different way.
Yes.
If she was not a former member of the Defence Forces, if she hadn't offended our sensibilities, and I'm not saying that lightly because I find what she said reprehensible, in her television interviews, if she was an Irish woman who somehow had just ended up there with a child in the camp, what would we be doing? We would be doing everything we could do to try and facilitate her repatriation to Ireland. So what is our problem with her? Our problem is the views that she is expressing. That's a pretty dangerous route to go down,
right,
to my mind.
Yeah.
So I would come back to, if she can be assisted without putting anybody else's life in danger, then I think she should be assisted, because we have not got to the stage where we require our citizens, whether they're at home
to
or abroad, to sign up to any particular sets of beliefs or values.
Well, true, but we do expect them to have... I don't know how to phrase this, but I mean, she said she didn't kill anybody. She won't kill anybody. There was an article today with a photograph of a woman in full hijab. Now, they were not saying that it was her, but the implication she had was that the women weren't allowed to do it. There was a woman shooting somewhere in some direction. We would take that into account, wouldn't we?
What she actually said, if I read it correctly, was that because she had had a child, she wouldn't have been allowed to do it.
Yeah.
I think she has been very foolish in what she has done, and that's maybe a kind way of putting it. I think she's been incredibly naive in the way she has appeared on the television and in the interviews she has given. Incredibly naive. But I come back to the fact that she has the same rights and her child has the same rights as any other Irish citizen, and we should not go down the road of treating them differently.
Thought police. Fergus, I mean... you have to have sympathy for somebody who's stuck in one of those camps, who's worried about a child. But I suppose it's the sceptic in me. She said she didn't know about this, she didn't know about that, she didn't know about the other. But if you want to go from Louds to the Caliphate, you have to do a certain amount of research.
You have to have resources. You have to be a resourceful person to do it.
And determined.
And a determined person to do it. I mean, she described herself in that interview yesterday as somebody who appeared to think the Caliphate was a land of milk and honey, and not the brutality that she encountered when she got there. And I don't... There wasn't a ring of truth about a single thing she said. So I think that makes her an untrustworthy and dislikable person, just on the basis of listening to that interview.
Which isn't a crime either.
Which is not a crime either. We have no choice in the matter. She's an Irish citizen. Oddly enough, and I'm sure a constitutional or legal expert might contradict me on this, I don't think her child is an Irish citizen, because we changed the law in this respect. We changed the constitution. The fact that she's born to an Irish woman means that she has an automatic right to entitlement to apply for Irish citizenship, and there's no reason why she wouldn't get it. But as of this moment, she's not an Irish citizen. Now, I think she should be treated like one.
Yeah.
I think she should be treated, you know, like any other child in this. She deserves absolute protection and absolute priority. But, you know, we did decide some years ago that we weren't going to continue with the business of granting people an automatic entitlement to citizenship just because they were born here or just because they had Irish... We had reasons for doing that, which weren't very worthy, but we did it.
I think she is an Irish citizen. I mean, I know I have had grandchildren born overseas and they were automatically Irish citizens.
They know they have an automatic entitlement to apply, and if they apply, they will be... If they will be granted Irish citizenship, but they weren't born Irish citizens, they would have been at one time. But since we changed the law, they're no longer.
I thought it was the other way around, that if you were a non-Irish citizen and you came over to Ireland to have your baby looking for Irish citizenship, that you wouldn't automatically get it.
And your baby wouldn't either, even though your baby be born here.
Okay, listen, we could go down those tracks.
Anyway, I think we all think she should come home or should be facilitated to come home, but she is, certainly the views she is expressing will make her an unsympathetic figure when she's here, and it is disturbing to hear those views. Now, perhaps she could have been described as naive in advance, but she can't be described as naive given what she's witnessed.
No. Right. I think that the Taoiseach commentary saying that she would be fully investigated if she arrived back protects the child and also the country.
Yeah. Mind you, it has to be said, throughout history, men and women of religious zeal have made the most extraordinary decisions about their own lives and where they will move to and how they will live their lives. And they're entitled to. Anyway, we'll cut on now to we might go to health. There's an article in the Sunday Business Post today, which is written by Tony O'Brien, who was the head of the HSE. And you remember all the outrage. And he left a matter of weeks earlier than would have. And he's writing about the HSE was given a non-executive board for the first time since 2011. And he goes on and goes on and goes on. And he really has a go at Fine Gael, has to be said. He calls what they did was governance vandalism by Fine Gael, as I was saying, you know, he was really holding back. And he went back to when James Riley took over, and he talked about him firing the board, and he said the with news crews at his side, he went on a choreographed walk, they're his words now, not mine, to fire the HSE, which he did, the board of the HSE. And then he went on to describe various things that happened in between. And you know what? As you read it, your heart would break for the nurses and the doctors and the care workers and all the rest of them, that they're doing their level best. But anyway, at a certain point, the SAC board was replaced by six senior Department of Health officials and six senior managers from the HSE. So that's the department and the HSE, referred to as an interim board, more theatre, he says, and was chaired by the Secretary General of the department, who was also the chairman of the HSE. Unbelievably, for the 2 years of this arrangement, the chairman of the HSE regularly wrote to himself as Secretary General of the department and then replied to himself. Like, you'd put your head in your... like, there are people in there killing themselves.
It gets worse, Marion. It gets worse.
You go on then.
Well, I suppose I have to be a bit careful
because I'm coming to that.
I am one of the people who has now been appointed to the board of the HSE.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I do feel it's really time that Tony O'Brien stopped pulling his punches.
Wait,
he
tell
really
me the rest
needs
of it.
To stop beating about the bush. that's a very funny bit that he tells there about the Secretary General of the Department as chair wrote to the Secretary General of the Department as Secretary General and then replied to himself. What Tony forgets to mention is that for the following 5 years, Tony O'Brien was himself chief executive and chair of the HSE. So for that 5 years, Tony O'Brien routinely, at least figuratively, wrote to himself and replied to himself and was accountable effectively to nobody else. I don't know what this article is about, to be honest, and I don't know why, and you'll appreciate I'm not carrying a torch for Fine Gael, but what Fine Gael has done is passed a piece of legislation which appoints, for the first time in 7 years, an independent board to the HSE, replacing a system of bureaucrats reporting to bureaucrats.
Yeah, but why did they fire the board in the first place?
No idea.
Because nobody had to answer to anybody.
Exactly. The rationale at the time, and it was mad. I've been writing about this for 5 years, Mary, and it flies in the face of every basic principle of decent governance that a body, especially the biggest bloody state-funded employer in the country, would not have any independent accountability structures. But I understand. My recollection is that the rationale at the time was the abolition of the board was intended to be the first phase of a major reform programme which would involve the restructuring and dismantling of the HSE. The only problem was it was the only phase at that stage. Nothing else ever happened afterwards. And that led to a situation where Tony O'Brien, a good man, a sound man, a fine man in all sorts of ways, was the effective dictator of the health service. He was the chief executive, he was the chairman. He was also, by the way, the spokesperson, the only visible manager ever. He was supposed to know everything. I remember there was a terrible scandal affecting Oris Attracta in Mayo.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
And I remember thinking at the time when I was listening to Tony O'Brien giving an interview, I'd bet you anything before that scandal broke, Tony O'Brien didn't know what RS Attractor was, where it was.
I think you mentioned that before,
and
yes.
I don't know how he could. You know, how you can be expected to take total and absolute responsibility for an organisation that's as widespread and as huge as the HSE.
And varied.
And that ultimately is why he failed. Ultimately is why he failed. I also think that the fact that he never, ever had to account to anybody cannot have been good for him.
No. I would have thought that as CEO, very nice to have a board and to have a good board and a strong board. Now tell me about your appointment to the board.
Well, I applied. I've written about governance issues in the HSE for a number of years. I've written about very, very critically about the HSE for a number of years. And then I saw an ad saying, you know, would you like to be interested in being on the board of the HSE? So I applied, I sent in my CV. Everyone else who's on the board did exactly the same thing. We applied for a variety of different reasons. And a board has now been constructed, which I think is a really effective board, which is very representative, which has some very, very powerful people, particularly powerful patient advocates on it. And we've met once formally and a number of times informally. We're still in the process of getting to know each other. We're still in the process of deciding how we work through priorities. We're still in the process of getting to know the new chief executive, whom we've met a couple of times. So, you know, we've got a five-year huge job of
work
to do.
You sure have.
And we're going to try and work together on it.
Just one question, Fergus. In what way will this board be different from the previous board?
There was no previous board. There hasn't been a previous board since.
But the one that was abolished. The one that was abolished by Minister Brennan
Riley. Was on it.
It won't be different in the sense in any sense of normal governance. It's different people. I hope it'll follow some of the same practices. You know, meeting in places other than Dublin, making its meetings much more accessible to the public, etc., etc.
But if you take the day-to-day experience of people trying to access health, you know, where you wait for 2.5 to 3 years to get an appointment with a consultant, that's not to get anything done to you. If you take the fact that they, well, obviously A&E run off their feet, that the amount of occupancy in the beds is bordering, according to some people, on dangerous. Every which way you look. And if you talk to the people at the coalface, they say it's all about the management. Management is far more important than the patients or their work.
Well, I don't want to pass a comment on that, but I know if you talk to, and I hope this board, and I think this board will do its damnedest to be representative of the people who use the HSE, people who need the HSE. And the experience of people who need the HSE is they provide a wonderful service when you get in.
Not always,
in general. I mean, there are reasonable grounds for saying that the vast majority of people have a good experience of the health service when they get access to it, but a terrible experience of the health service in terms of getting access to it. And there's this huge split as well between those who have private health insurance and those who don't, and the difference. I mean, I had reason a couple of years ago to need healthcare, and I was told, if you have private health insurance, we can do it on Thursday. If you don't, we can put you on a list.
Which you do?
I went for the private health insurance, Marion, because the need was urgent.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's what my people have it.
Yeah,
and it's the tragedy that others
it
can't
is a scandal,
get the same.
Not just a tragedy. Yeah. It's a scandal.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things that a behemoth of a health system can't approach without very, very significant reform. It's why Sláintecare is so important. It's why it is the priority of the board to try to begin to approach Sláintecare in a meaningful way.
Mary-Wayne,
could I just ask, Fergal, what for you will be a successful membership of the HSE board? In 5 years' time, when you look back, what will you have achieved?
Well, I'm not going to talk about me. I don't want to say this is what the board would regard as success, but I think we have to make real inroads in the quality of people's experience, the quality and of access to the health system, and the quality of patient safety and care. I also think we have to turn what is a very often impenetrable system into one that is much more transparent and honest about its mistakes. The worst thing you can do in the health system at the moment is make a mistake. You'll be
hung out
to dry.
Everybody makes a mistake in every walk of life.
Of course they do, but it's not considered acceptable if you're working in the health system. And that's why there is a policy of open disclosure, but there certainly isn't a culture of open disclosure. So they're the kind of things that I think... And I mean, I'm sufficiently realistic to think that if we made... If we got decent increments of progress in those areas and laid foundations for a second 5 years, you'd be doing a good job.
Ken, you want to get in there?
I'm just really, it is almost intractable. It's been going on for so long, the problems with the health service. We've been looking at, you know, decades of situations whereby the amount of expenditure on health seems to rise, but the problems don't seem to improve. And I wish you well is all I can say in terms of clearly something has to be done, because the expenditure level per capita by the Irish state on health seems to be among the highest in the world, but we don't seem to get the return for it. And nobody, there are all sorts of theories as to why that is the case. I don't know why it's the case. I wish you well in finding out why it's the case and if we can get a better outcome.
Is it just too big? I wonder if it's just...
But Marion, how could it be too big? We have a population of less than 5 million. It's a medium-sized city in many large countries. Yeah. And we expend a huge amount of money on this service. So it can't be that it's too big. It's maybe...
I think it's too big to
be
manageable.
The management is too big.
I think it's too big to be manageable.
Maybe we need to break it down into primary health care.
Well, then maybe
hospital care,
go back to
community care.
I mean, it's entirely arguable, I think, that an organisation that has to run 60 hospitals and provide an extraordinary variety of community services as one organisation is far too big. Mm. Until 1970, you remember, Marion, we ran all our health services at a county level. And that was seen as not working, although it was much more responsive.
Yeah.
It was seen as not working because of all the arguments about centres of excellence and so on. And we replaced that with 8 health boards. Then we refined that by having 3 different health boards in Dublin, and the 8 became 11. And then we decided, for some reason, to set up this thing called the HSE. And we put everything into that. We didn't at the time rationalise the management structures. We did, you know, we just added layer upon layer upon layer of management bureaucracy. And you know, we created a very, 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 very unwieldy and remote setup.
Well, if you take the point you were making about St. Detractus, if you've got 130,000 staff, you cannot possibly know... every detail of it. So perhaps what you have to do is do little clusters. I mean, I know of one service that's available from NACE, because I availed of it myself, works like a treat. No messing, on time, in the door, out the door, and works perfectly.
As a public service, and you can avail of it as a public service, many of them do exist all around the country.
Yeah. But you get these little pockets that work, and then you get ones that just... are just so dysfunctional, Ciarán.
Well, I think the construct of the HSE was all wrong. I mean, that was in Bertie's time, I think, as Taoiseach and Ferguson.
Was Michael Martin Minister for Health.
Yeah. Then Mary Harney designed it. B.L. Martin designed it and Mary Harney implemented it one way or the other.
Yeah. And we created this monster, effectively. It's, it seems to me to be terribly bureaucratic. I wish Fergus and his colleagues on the board luck in terms of trying to sort out this issue. And we have a perennial issue as well in terms of budgeting, in that they seem to go massively over the budget every year. I mean, last year I think it was of the order of about 700 million euro or thereabouts. And they seem to be on target this year so far, but there is an expectation.
No, there are overruns already, but the Exchequer figures that were saying no.
Well, the Exchequer figures that were released during the week don't indicate that. However, a lot of economists and commentators and so forth feel that those overruns will emerge in the second half of the year, especially in the run-up to the budget, we'll see. But either way, in terms of governance and in terms of management, I think it's probably too big.
I wonder if that's just it, that it has to be split up, that it's too big.
Well, I think it's too big. As you say, when you set down all of the figures that you mentioned earlier in terms of the number of staff and the number of hospitals and everything else, maybe they need a restructuring on a provincial or a regional level under a national board of the HSE, but that there's a lot more power given locally and a lot more...
That's largely what Sláintecare, which is the national policy accepted by all political parties.
Yes.
That's what it envisages. It envisages effectively a breakup of the HSE.
Because there are illogical things happening in the sense that people talk about people not being discharged. Elderly people, old people and infirm people who would 50 times prefer to be in their own home. And to get home care is much cheaper than to be in a hospital bed. So you think, hello...
Yeah. Marion, we also have to take into consideration the problem with doctors, rural GPs. Like, we're not attracting GPs into local, so people are bypassing. People who move into areas can't get into a doctor's practice, so they're bypassing that and they're going to the after-hours doctor. If they can't do anything for them, then they're going straight into the hospitals.
You may have seen the story, it was a very recent story, of a ill young man who can't leave hospital because the HSE cannot supply a wheelchair. And the wheelchair, it's an expensive wheelchair which needs to be adapted and equipped to his needs. It's probably about €18,000. So far, it has cost more than €120,000 to keep that young man in hospital. It's nutty, nutty. And somewhere in the middle of all that, there's a HSE manager who needs to make a decision.
There are all sorts of conflicts within the system as well. You know, we have the age-old problem around hospital consultants who are working both for the public hospitals but are also working privately for patients, and that's a real conflict of interest, I think.
In what way?
Well, I don't see how you can serve both masters. Clearly they do. But, I mean, there is and we've had this issue over the years, haven't we, whereby they're using public facilities for their private practice.
Well, I don't know if you've ever heard Michael O'Keefe talk about it, because he worked in the public and the private sector. And he's very eloquent about it, and he figured that it worked.
He
and
justifies
he works his back off. Really does.
He's retired now. My daughter is a patient and went to him publicly. Well, when we were referred from a private doctor to Michael O'Keefe publicly.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean? And then when he retired, the hospital rang us to tell us to go back to our private doctor.
He didn't want to retire.
No.
And all those skills. So he's now only available in the private sector. But I think he still does the premature babies. Every morning does the rounds at the maternity hospital. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just wondering where political accountability is in all of this. We don't have a good health system. We spend an awful lot of money in it. We've had ministers over the years who've come and gone. We've had regional health boards. We've had the HSE. We've had co-location. Now we've Sláintecare. We're moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic. And there is never accountability at the political level. What minister for health has actually lost his job because of incompetence? It is absolutely staggering, I think. What is the role? We know what the role of the HSE is now with its board. What is the role of the Minister for Health?
We have former ministers for health who go on to become Taoiseach.
Or aspire to become Taoiseach.
Or actually become Taoiseach.
Yeah.
Brian Cowan, Leo Varadkar.
Yes, yeah, Micheál Martin.
He's not Taoiseach.
Aren't
yet,
we?
No. Hold on.
Aren't
hold
we
on.
Very complacent? You know, it's great to have people like Fergus on a board, but the people that we, the people, have elected seem to just go on to bigger and better things each time.
To be fair to Micheál Martin, wasn't he Minister for Health when the smoking ban was introduced?
He was
progressive.
That was a big success.
He also became known as Minister for Reports. He got more reports done.
Well, isn't that indicative maybe of what all we're talking about here, is that nobody really knows the answer to this problem? You know, there's reports, there are proposals, there are reviews and so on.
And
then new policies are tried and then they're abandoned and additional ones are introduced again.
They don't say, and about our health policy, we don't know what to do. You know, they all come out with health,
none of them were going to tell
health
you that.
Policies. The Fine Gael campaign, was it in the
2011?
Yes,
2011.
Promised us Dr.
Riley.
Dutch system.
The Dutch system.
Yes, which
well,
works
that was
great,
a disaster.
Except the Dutch system costs an enormous amount of money,
yeah,
even by our standards.
But I say policies are adopted, abandoned, and reversed.
And we don't care.
I suppose, to be fair, though, I mean, over the years in Ireland, we've had great and not so great ministers for health, ministers for finance, ministers for foreign affairs, ministers for transport, ministers for tourism. Don't talk to me about ministers for tourism. And nobody ever loses their job on the basis, in Irish politics, on the basis of they're not very good at it. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, if you're not very good at a job in Irish politics, you get moved to a better job.
I thought that when there was a disagreement, I'm talking ministers for finance now, when there was a disagreement in the early 2000s after the dot-com bubble, when Charlie McCreevy is often misquoted as saying, when I have it, I spend it. Mm-hmm. But the end of that quote was, when
yes,
I don't, I won't.
It's a truncated quote. Yeah.
And very shortly after that, he was sent off to Brussels. And
European Internal Market Commissioner Bertie Ahern was repositioning the government.
Yeah. And they did win the next election, you know.
Mm. Well, Brian Cowan won it for them.
Mm.
Anyway,
yeah,
different story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I work in the HSE, says a caller, and I see waste and inefficiency on a daily basis. As a manager, when I try to improve things, I'm blocked by poor management, unions or bureaucracy. It's massively frustrating. I don't see it ever changing. And I do remember Susan Mitchell did a, for the Business Post, did a very comprehensive thing, and that there are all these vested interests. You know, you don't cross
a lot of
my
silos, a lot of, you know, unions and a lot of, you know, disputes.
Back off my territory, more or less. Mm-hmm. Another one said, as far as I know, the HSE was formed to save money by joining various health boards together and consequently saving money on management and admin staff. This never happened. Well, that's very true.
And the opposite happened.
The absolute opposite happened and everybody was kept on. Another caller says, Pascal Donoghue writes to himself all the time, finance and public expenditure reform should be separated. Mm. I don't see it as the kind of man that would write to himself all the time. But there you go. Marion, are there any
It's said of Pascal O'Donoghue that if he gets a letter from himself, he tends to ignore it.
All right, OK. Marion, are there any frontline staff on the new HSE board? Another one says, wouldn't it make sense to have a nurse representative and a GP representative on the HSE board?
There is actually a general practitioner on the HSE. There isn't a nurse representative. There are two. I think there are two people with clinical backgrounds.
And, two. Yeah. Because there's another caller, how many physicians and nurse managers are on the HSE board? So I presume people will be going on. I think
the point about state boards, though, and it's a general point, what is most important is independence. Mm-hmm. You know, the more you appoint, and I've been critical of the Bar Council in the past, for example.
Never.
Yes, I have, because it's a council that represents itself and accounts to itself and is staffed up by lawyers and et cetera. Now, they have done a bit of reform lately, but I think the more vested interest you put on a board, the less independence it's going to have.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, listen, we needed to take a break here. I have a lot of other calls coming in as well. With us in studio this morning, Amy McKeever, Fergus Finlay, Kieran Hancock, Ken Murphy and Mary Whelan, back after this. Welcome back to the programme. Now, just flipping back to what we were talking earlier, I want to go to a few calls that came in. Marion, I think the tone of the Lisa Smith commentary would be different if she were an Irish man. I don't think the tone would be quite so compassionate. I deeply believe she's a risk to Irish society and we should proceed with caution. And, you know, you could be right on that, that there would be more condemnation if it were a man. I don't know. Marion, you're automatically an Irish citizen if one of your parents was an Irish citizen and was born in Ireland. You don't need to apply to become an Irish citizen in this case. And this is from the Department of Foreign Affairs website. Well, we won't go back to that just at the moment. Marion, the most, that's going back to, if she and her child are brought back to Ireland, does that mean the father of her child can join her here and get status here in Ireland? The answer to that is nil issigum. I don't know. But we'd see now. I want to go to, because there's a lot of coverage, and as I said, the Business Post go big on it today. They have a story on influx of overseas fraudsters. That's an insurance. Sunday Business Post on 8 and 9, insurance uncovered. Sunday Business Post, it's high time insurance fraud became a crime of consequence. And Sunday Business Post covers Sinn Féin's Piers Doherty, who really sold it in to them. I'm going to come to you, Ken, on this first. We're tight enough on time.
Piers Doherty was very strong. This was a bad week for the insurers in front of the Oireachtas Finance Committee. And I must say, Sinn Féin's finance spokesman, Piers Doherty, launched into them with a forensic-type cross-examination, which exposed that two things are going up here. Insurance premiums for businesses are going up and insurance company profits are going up. Their profits are becoming astonishing. And profiteering has been a comment made by Minister Darcy, Minister Flanagan and so on. But Piers Doherty pointed out that AXA's profits totaled 89 million on premium income of 770, which was a profit margin of 11.5%.
Not bad.
Compared to their target, their announced target in advance was 5%. FBD, I won't go through all the others, FBD and others, they all came up with very... And the other thing that he was making is not just that the profits seem to be extraordinary on the basis of the ever-increasing premiums, but that the claims that the insurance industry are making about fraud and exaggeration contributing to, you know, to the levels of premiums, that those claims in themselves are false and exaggerated. That's effectively what he's saying. That and as I say, we have to bear in mind the insurance industry is under two investigations by both national and EU cartel investigations at the moment, and in terms of their capacity to say if a wars in Ireland are too high, and the Judicial Council Bill was passed earlier this week, and there is mechanism
explain
now.
Explain that very briefly to
that's
people.
Going to be under by agreement something that's tagged on to the Judicial Council Bill. It's now there, was passed through both houses, I believe, this week. Is that a body of judges are going to look at premium levels with a view effectively to reducing, not premium levels, damages levels, because they are higher than in England and Wales.
Yeah.
But the real question really is whether, if there is a reduction in awards and a benefit from that, who will benefit from it? Will it be the premium payers or the insurers? Will the insurers simply pocket it themselves? Because the suggestion is that they might. And there'll be no benefit. The victims will have their injuries reduced. There'll be no benefit to premium payers. The insurance industry's profits will increase even further.
Right.
And there are allegations about the level of fraud and exaggeration. I would encourage people to look back on the Oireachtas website and see the way those allegations were really destroyed by Piers Doherty and the Oireachtas this week.
Okay, Kieran.
I think the insurance companies would probably say that they made heavy losses in the years before that. But anyway, they can speak for themselves. I think one of the problems in this area is that the insurance companies have never really been transparent about the number of claims they have, the number of claims that are investigated for potential fraud,
etc.,
etc., etc.
You've heard endless people on the radio saying they settled, even though I wasn't in the wrong, and they settled without consulting with me, those kind of things.
Yeah, and in the Sunday Business Post today, there's a lot of that as well from some company owners, hotel owners, restaurant owners, etc., who are saying that their claims were jacked up massively, even though they either had no claims or in some cases very small claims, and still they went up and they could only get insurance from their existing insurers. Nobody else wanted to touch them. There's probably lots of anecdotal evidence around it. I think the insurance industry has a lot to do in terms of transparency and in terms of making it very clear.
To what extent can the government dictate? Because they're beating their breast now for I don't know how long and wringing their hands and saying they're doing their very best. Well, it's not succeeding. Are they limited in what they can do?
Well, they can do certain things, all right. I mean, they set up this interdepartmental group to look at it, and they came up with 70 or 80 recommendations, but that's going back a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And Michael Darcy is the man in charge. He's the junior minister and the minister...
And he's doing a good job, I would say. He can in a difficult situation.
But it's not changing the circumstances for the people on the ground.
No,
I mean, that's the purpose of it, it's the exercise.
But it's just the Finance Committee this week seemed certainly, from my perspective, to expose real flaws in maybe we're getting close to the core of the problem, which is excessive profits by the insurers and excessive claims about fraud and, okay. And exaggeration.
I think a big concern that the Sunday Business Post, they actually spoke about it last month in the paper about the voluntary and local communities that they have all these resources that they can't actually use. So the government is investing millions and millions of euros through leader funding or different bits and pieces to build these community projects. And if they're sitting idly by, the government needs to take action on this to make sure that those facilities are usable by people. And they said here that the big fear amongst the WEEL, the organisation's members, that they'd be forced to close because of the existential threat posed by rising insurance costs up to 500%.
Yeah.
It's interesting, in that interview I did with Matt Ryan in Preston a couple of weeks ago, he said that they spend over €700,000 a year on insurance premiums. Now, they've more than 40 venues. It's a big disparate company, but nonetheless,
how much?
It's over €700,000. Somewhere between 700,000 and a million was his sort of top.
It's a lot of lucre, but proportionately, if you hear people with small companies and little playgrounds and
bouncing,
all of those things, in
crashes in play centres and under terrible threat.
Yeah. But isn't it related to the fact that we're very litigious? I mean, they wouldn't need insurance if it wasn't the case that if a child falls and hurts its knee, the parents may take a case. Mm. Or people are not expected to exercise normal security and precaution in relation to themselves. Isn't that part of the problem?
I was wondering when somebody was going to be unkind enough to mention that.
Well, no, of course we should deal with profits.
Ken had up to now done an absolutely brilliant job of avoiding mentioning legal costs.
But the point, Mary, is that...
I mean, every time a child falls and hurts his knee, there is a solicitor nearby.
Yes.
But there is also no successful claim that can be brought unless there is actual negligence by the part of the person who caused the accident.
For no reason. It is not for no reason that the word ambulance chaser exists.
No. There has to be, I have to say, I'm not going to hide from this. It is a perfectly valid social service for people are injured through the negligence of others to assist them to get the compensation.
Okay, so a social service. You got that wrong.
How come our social service in relation to things like whiplash, which may or may not exist as a medical condition, how come that it costs so much?
Listen, I'm going to have to go to the newsroom. I'm so sorry. I hate to let Ken off the hook. But anyway, saved by the bell, and we go to the newsroom. And James Healy.
I wanted to go.
And thank you very, very much indeed for that. Now, there's been widespread coverage this week about the story of Princess Haya bint Al Hussein, one of the wives of the ruler of Dubai, Sheikh Mohammed Al Maktoum. You may remember I spoke to Princess Haya back in January when our former president, Mary Robinson, visited her in Dubai following international concern over the welfare of Princess Sheikha Latifa. Now, Princess Haya is herself in the news because she has left her husband, a highly unusual move for a senior royal in the UAE. And it's written up all along that she's hiding. Well, she's hiding apparently in a house that she bought. She paid 85 million for it. So maybe she's staying in there in protection, if you know what I mean, in a townhouse in central London. Well, I'm joined now on the line by Radha Starling, who's founder and CEO of an organisation called Detained in Dubai. First of all, you're very welcome to the programme, Radha Starling. What do you do and how did the organisation come about and why?
The organisation I founded around 11 years ago when a friend and colleague of mine was detained in the UAE. He was facing injustices and unfair trials and wrongful conviction. And after his release, that became quite prominent in the media, a lot of people continued to contact me. And I realized that his case wasn't isolated and just sort of naturally started this organization.
And can you remind listeners of the story, kind of the more recent story, starting with Latifa, but also her sister?
Yes. Her sister, Sheikha Shamsa, was allegedly kidnapped by Sheikh Mohammed's people from the streets of Cambridge. And there is an ongoing investigation into that case through the Cambridge police. Then after that, Latifa, her younger sister, had tried to escape after she witnessed alleged abuse that her sister had suffered, such as forced medication and various other ill treatments.
She made a film about it.
Yes. Latifa had tried to escape previously, and she was caught, and then she was imprisoned and tortured as per her video testimony. And her most recent escape led to her capture from a yacht, a US-flagged yacht in international waters, in a military operation, which led to her being brought back to Dubai.
Now, she was on the phone to you, as I understand it, from that yacht, when they were boarded by a military-type force.
That's right. She telephoned me during the attack and said that she heard gunshots outside, that she was frightened, and asked me to please help. Then all communications with all people on board the yacht were terminated, and I didn't hear from them until their later release. Unfortunately, we haven't heard from Latifa since then, except in the visit that Mary Robson attended in December at the request of Princess Haya. Obviously, that was also widely publicised, and she was criticised for having circumvented normal United Nations protocols because the UAE had not replied to UN requests to visit Latifa. And instead, Princess Haya then asked Mary Robinson to come instead, and she said that she was in the safe and loving care of her family. Now, the world didn't really believe that. And now that we've seen Princess Haya coming out and saying essentially that she was seeking asylum, that she's fearful for her life, and now she's being taken to court by Sheikh Mohammed in the UK for the return of her children to Dubai. So she will obviously, during that court case, have to provide testimony as to the ill treatment of Latifa if she's to prevent the children being sent back to Dubai.
Okay. Princess Haya, as I say, spoke in January last on the programme, and she referred to the situation with Princess Latifa as a deeply private matter. We can listen now to her explaining that. And as far as she's concerned, there was at that point anyway, no truth behind the concerns being raised about Latifa.
If I thought for a single second that any shred of this was true, I wouldn't put up with it or stand for it. You might not know, but my mother died when I was 3 in a helicopter accident. And I live every single day needing to know that if anything ever happened to me, that my children would be loved and cared for and supported and done right by. And that's unequivocal. Their right to freedom, their right to safety, their right to everything else they deserve as human beings is something that if I thought for a single millisecond was not the case, I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't stand for it.
That sounds like a ring of great sincerity, would you think?
I would think so, but given that she is in the position of being required, probably, to give that sort of testimony, and now with her subsequent actions and reports in the media saying that following that interview, she investigated further into the case of Latifa and discovered things that that she obviously didn't like. She perhaps discovered the abuse, discovered that she was being imprisoned. And you have to remember that Princess Haya apparently hadn't seen Latifa since that attack, except for that single day, and didn't see her after that one visitation.
You know, Mary Robinson, our former president, has a very distinguished record as a lawyer, and a human rights lawyer, and that's been her area of expertise, or commitment, I suppose, is what I should say, particularly since she left the presidency. But you're very cross with her about this.
Well, given that it circumvented usual UN protocols where they would send a team of people who were trained to see whether Latifa was under duress during that meeting, and Mary had a meeting with Latifa for several hours only, or two or three hours perhaps, and then came out with a report saying that she's absolutely fine. And clearly, from Latifa's testimony, she's never been fine in the custody of her family.
Fergus Findlay, you know Mary Robinson very well. You were part of her election campaigning going way back. Wasn't it odd that she would give, as it were, a diagnosis?
Well, it seems very odd on the face of it because she's not a psychiatric expert or a health expert. But I think any of us who've ever worked with Mary Robinson wouldn't question her integrity for a second, wouldn't question her commitment to human rights for a second. I mean, I don't understand this story. It seems incredibly complex and arcane and you know, all sorts of peculiar elements of divorce and acrimony and so on are tied up in it as well. And obviously huge amounts of money at play. And it may be that Mary Robinson made an error of judgment in being dragged into the middle of it. I'd be amazed if anyone would question her good faith in the matter, though.
Mary, what do you think?
It's like a children's fairy tale. I mean, maybe the wicked stepmother isn't there, but all the other ingredients are there. There's princesses, there's sheikhs, there's boats at sea. It's very hard to get your head around this, but insofar as our former president, Mary Robinson, was involved, perhaps she would, well, almost certainly she was mistaken to get involved in such a public way and make an assertion on matters of somebody's mental health or otherwise. But I don't doubt her, very much like Fergal, I would not doubt her goodwill. But it's just an extraordinary story. I can't relate it to anything.
Right. And since, in her own statement last December, Mary Robinson said, since her return from Dubai, I've written a report of my visit to Michelle Bachelet, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. I believe future action rests with that office, with the UN Committee on Enforced Disappearances, and with the Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Summary or Arbitrary Executions. She says that she undertook the visit and made an assessment, not a judgment. Would you go along with that or no, Arada, and just say she should not have done it?
The issue is that in having done that, Latifah's case could potentially have been closed as far as the investigation is concerned. And if the UAE, under such public scrutiny, with such disbelief over Mary Robinson's report, should then cooperate with the further requests that the UN has made to them for visitation to Latifah, and they simply haven't responded, not even to a request for proof of life.
Well, I think what you were saying about the upcoming court case. Now, it's all kind of alarming because you read that they've hired protection, that they've looked for protection from the police, who say they don't talk about individual cases. And like there are suggestions that her own life now, Princess Haya, could be at risk. But
yes.
Are we not getting into like the realms of the unbelievable to think that could happen?
No, I really don't think we are. What we're seeing is an increased belligerent behaviour coming from the Gulf region. We're seeing Saudi able to kill Khashoggi in an embassy in Turkey. We're seeing an attack on an international yacht. We're seeing previously his two children have been seized from outside of the UAE jurisdiction. And I would say that Princess Haya is at extreme risk, and also obviously his children. He has a history of unlawfully, extrajudicially returning his children back to the UAE. So I can understand why they would be on complete lockdown with extreme security.
Right. And of course, there's also the question of the rules and regulations in the British jurisdiction would be somewhat different to that in the UAE. But I got the impression when I was speaking to her and her, well, I wasn't speaking to her people, but researchers were and producers, there was huge emphasis on the fact that she is the daughter of the King of Jordan. And I thought it was interesting that emphasis was laid. And does that make her less vulnerable than the other wives if they step out of line?
potentially that does afford her some sort of protection. And obviously Jordan is trying to step back and would definitely not want her to return to that country, which is why the United Kingdom is actually a very safe choice for her. Obviously, the ramifications of trade agreements and all sorts of agreements between those countries are being negotiated behind the scenes. And the UAE will definitely be trying to work with Jordan to convince them, to convince her higher to cooperate. But if she went back to Dubai, her former husband, or about-to-be former husband, he owns the courts, he rules the courts, and there is no separation of state and judiciary. So she wouldn't stand a chance at winning any kind of custody back there. And she stands the risk that those children are also going to be locked up under house arrest or imprisoned simply to keep them away from her, just like in the case of Latifa.
Right. I mean, it is like the golden cage, isn't it? Like you can be behind walls or behind windows, but if you don't have freedom, it's and we don't know. I mean, how much do you know, for example, about who is the mother of those two daughters and where does she fit into all this jigsaw puzzle?
Yes, exactly. I mean, he's allegedly got six wives, but there's also reports that he has, in fact, more. There's official reports that he has 23 children, where we know that he has 31 or more. Princess Haya was his most public wife. She attended all of the events with him.
Yeah.
So it was actually very surprising that she's now fled, essentially, and fled with the children in quite a dramatic political way. So the other wives, they've been just pretty much hidden away and no one knows anything about them. They don't attend the events with him. But certainly Princess Haya has been quite his advocate for a number of years.
Yes, and talked about the loving family there, and clearly talked about the loving family to Mary Robinson. But you kind of wonder what goes on behind those walls. Does one bit of a family know what the other bit of a family is doing? Amy, what do you make of it?
Well, Princess Haya spent quite a lot of time here in the early 90s. She trained here under Paul Dara, the show jumper. She was quite an accomplished equestrian.
That's right. And she stayed with the Mount Charles.
Yeah, and she represented Jordan in 2000 Olympics. And she would have been, a very well-known figure in show jumping circles here when she was here. But I think that the difference here, and Latifa is technically her stepdaughter, is that, you know what I mean? She was kind of, I suppose, they said she was vulnerable and that she needed protection, and that they were slightly able to kind of bury that story. The Mary Robinson element certainly raised it a higher profile than it possibly would have if Mary Robinson hadn't gone out there. But Princess Haya is well known internationally. She's a global figure.
Chaired.
And, she has an opportunity here, I suppose, you know what I mean, to lift the lid on what's after happening. And it depends on, there's various stories across the paper over the week about why she's fled, and I'm not going to comment on which ones are true or false.
Yes.
But because we don't know, but and then with her husband posting on Instagram, and
about the husband's post.
So he's writing poetry, and the translation, basically the one that stood out for me is identifying an unidentified woman, I don't care if you live or die. So I think that, you know what I mean, to post something like that on a social media account when his wife has just fled to London would make you think. And
it's,
I suppose,
bizarre.
Yeah.
And he mentioned treason. Mm. Ken,
that's
yes.
Right. Yeah, the actual wording, it's in the Sunday Times piece here today, and it says, I'm quoting, Haya's role in the saga remains murky. In a poem posted on Instagram, Maktoum accused an unidentified woman of, quotes, treachery and betrayal, warned that, quotes, the era of your lies has ended, and concluded, I don't care if you live or die. This isn't a poem. Anyway, all I can say is, having known very little about this story until we began to, it is becoming more and more fascinating.
It really is. And it raises other issues, you know, about blind eyes and money and all of that. Like, if you take that Donald Trump's first trip was to Saudi, where he was thrilled with himself because he had done this deal, where women are perpetually infantilized, and I mean, a car is not a really big deal, but we allow 17, 18 year olds to do that, and they are allowed to walk on their own in a park with their kids. And we just go with it and like to do business with them. And we do business with them too, don't we?
A couple of months ago, one of a previous reporter for Irish Country Living, Yvonne Kerr, is actually living in the Emirates now. Mm. And she wrote a story for us. But, it was about her life, which is quite nice, yeah. As an expat. But she wrote a box text about the dark side of Dubai, and that was really the piece that was of most interest to our readers. And in it she said that of the 9.4 million inhabitants that make up the Arab Peninsula, 70% are low paid migrant labourers from countries such as India, Indonesia and Philippines, and they technically have no rights at all. They're unskilled foreign workers and they must have a sponsor. She said she was lucky, she was sponsored by her husband who was a New Zealander, and that her life was quite pleasant. But you know what I mean? It's not just women in these countries. There is fundamental differences between lives here and lives there.
There's going to be huge issues of women's rights and workers' rights in that part of the world. Yeah. I mean, we're all going to take part in a World Cup soon, which mm-hmm. seems to have been built on the back of slave labour. Incredible mm-hmm. exploitation
and many
of
deaths.
Slavery. And many, many, mm-hmm. many deaths. And you know, the treatment of women, we know about. I'm really struggling to figure out how this story fits in. And it may be my own stupidity. It feels very much like I'm being asked to comment on the third series of Dallas, never having watched the first two series. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an incredibly complicated story of divorce and money and bitterness and so on. But is it more than that? Is it really more than that in this particular case? Or should we be concentrating on the point you were making a minute ago about how women are treated generally and about how migrant workers are treated? Yeah.
Radha?
Certainly. We've seen a lot of women trying to escape the Gulf region. From the Emirates recently, we had Hind al-Baluchi, who sought asylum in Germany. We've had Rahaf Mohammed, who was obviously a very public case again, and she went to Canada. And I'm getting more and more phone calls all the time from women who are in abusive situations, are unable to get legal support for that. So we have a huge problem, and yet we've got these countries, especially Dubai, marketing that women have all of the freedoms, all of the rights. They have women on boards of companies and so on. But that's just a very small layer of the problems there. We have also women making reports that they've been raped and then being charged with having sex outside marriage and jailed for it. So there is absolutely a prejudice against women in the Middle East.
One of the things about the same Sheikh Maktoum, Emir, I might go to you on this, like he has extensive involvement in Ireland, and everybody's heard of Godolphin, and you see photographs of him with the Queen, and in parts of Kildare they will sing his praises because of employment, good employers and all of that. How do you think that'll go down here?
Well, he does have considerable investments here, and his breeding operations would be worldwide renowned, and he's won a lot of races here. His wife would have accompanied him to a lot of those, but she's friendly with the Irish, I suppose, in her own right,
separate
to him. You know what I mean? She was here in her own right, show jumping in a separate industry, and show jumping a separate industry to the horse racing industry. You know what I mean? It will depend on how this all plays out in the courts, and it's going to be much more public because there's two children involved as well. The fact that she took the two kids to London with her, and that he's going to want to have those back, I think that public perception will be guided by that.
Well, that's very traditional. You hear about that all over the place. That in some Muslim societies, the children stay with the man's family, not necessarily when they're very young, but certainly when they get to a certain age, they go back to their dad. Used to be that you only got custody if you were a woman here. I mean, these things...
Different,
yeah. God, I was going to say horses, but I won't. But I have met a number of people who knew her when she was here, because she was here for quite a while. A range of people, and they were very impressed with her. She wasn't kind of looking to be treated like a princess every hour of the day, and she got stuck in and she worked very hard and, you know, improved her own skills, and then she ended up chairing one of the international equestrian federations, and I'm advised that she beat it into shape, you know, that it was all over the place. Hardin, you're now wearing your diplomatic hat. Where do... How do you interpret what's happening here? I mean, clearly, listening to our guest, Radha Stirling, they're going to keep pursuing this. We're going to see coverage of the... There'll be widespread coverage of the court case, should it happen. Is it embarrassing for us? We do business, all of that?
It's about as embarrassing as it is for everybody else who does business, which is to say not very embarrassing at all. I think there are a few things here. I mean, this clearly will all play out. It's going to be a difficult divorce. There's a lot of money at stake. There are children at stake. Maybe some good will come out of that, in that maybe it will shed some light on what exactly has been going on in the family. There's a bigger issue about the UAE and about the Emirates. They have been very active, as have other countries in the region, in the regional tensions that have gone on. And now the region is extending into North Africa, and the UAE backs one group in Libya, and the Saudis back another group. And it is a very complicated political situation that maybe we should be paying more attention to, other than the goings-on of the royal family. Should we be doing business with them? Well, if we stop doing business with people who we've question marks over, we won't be doing a lot of business. And that's a choice we can make. But for the moment, there are no sanctions on the UAE. Right. There is considerable UAE investment in Ireland, and there are a lot of Irish people working in the Gulf. And a lot of those people went there during our own recession, when our construction industry was going down the tubes, and that's where they got work. And right. We should remember that too.
Okay. Okay, we'll leave that there for the moment. I just go back to you briefly, if I may, Radha. How do you see the next bit of this unfolding?
Well, I think it was quite the mistake of Sheikh Mohammed to actually take this matter to court and not try to resolve it more diplomatically between them. In the UK, we've refused, all UK courts, Scotland and England, have refused all extraditions to the UAE. And that's pretty much Europe-wide as well. Because of the real risk of unfair trials, of human rights violations and even torture, the UAE hasn't taken any steps to improve the human rights situation there to allow us to extradite people, despite the fact that we have a treaty. And those same rules are going to be applied in the court case. If it can be proved that these children would potentially face risk if returned to the UAE, they won't be returned. And during these proceedings, obviously, there's the opportunity for Princess Haya to call on Sheikha Latifah to testify in her case, which could then shed further light on Latifah's plight. And then we have other children who are of Sheikh Mohammed, who are on even more lockdown and security following Latifah's attempted escape. So all of these issues, I think, are going to be brought to the public light. He's been the ambassador for Dubai for a long time, and he's been very popular, promoted the country, and he was actually quite liked. But recently, he's made so many errors of judgment and so many blatant acts of disregard for international law that he's seriously damaging the image of the country, and that could even lead to him having to hand over power to his son. Abu Dhabi, who's the powerhouse in the UAE, is not going to be very pleased at all with these acts that are essentially only coming from Sheikh Mohammed and causing such damage to the country as a whole.
Right. One last question. In this jurisdiction, family law is held in camera. Is it the same in Britain?
I believe that these court proceedings will be quite private, so there will be a lot of information available, and a lot of information will certainly be leaked, but overall the proceedings will be kept private.
Okay, we will watch with interest. And Radha Stirling of Detained in Dubai, thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Welcome back to the programme. And just briefly referring back again to matters to do with health. Morning, Marion. I'm a retired doctor who worked in the HSE. I would like all managers to describe exactly what they do, as there seems to be a great deal of duplication of responsibility. I may be wrong in my assumption. And another one says, can we not have our own national insurance scheme and cut out all the middlemen? And why do we spend more on healthcare and with poorer outcomes than any other country? Somebody pointed out to me this thing about there are sections that work really, really well, and I don't want to rat on anybody who is running such a successful unit in case a manager interferes. But, I mean, one person who does this, keeps staff, minds them, you know, and hangs on to them, very good outcomes, happy team, etc., etc., etc. And her brother-in-law, well, actually it's her sister-in-law, is in a different place. And if she, somebody asks her for a Panadol, she nearly has to get permission in Dublin. Now, there's a wonderful unit working really well. And then another system where you can't give a Panadol. I won't ask you to respond to that because you're not in the gig yet. Now, beef, beef, beef. What is the beef? Obviously, I'm going to start with you, Amy, on this. Have the farmers kind of slightly lost the plot with an overreaction on this? I mean, if Brexit goes badly for us, I presume we'll be going to Europe to say, please, sir, or please, madam, as it very well may be, can you help us out here? Because our industry, agriculture industry, is being affected. Like, it's not an amazing amount of beef that's coming in. And there has to be quid pro quos and deals.
I suppose there's a couple of things. So this is well covered across all the papers and it has been covered all week and on a lot of radio shows. But the Sunday Business Post has Humphreys, the IFA and the Battle of Kildare Street as their heading.
That's very interesting. Yes. Describe that to folk.
So Heather Humphreys, Minister for Enterprise, you know what I mean, is welcoming this, saying that there's opportunities to double exports to the Mercosur countries. And you know what I mean, that is positive. And as you said, bit of quid pro quo. We do need trade. We're an open economy. The IFA are very against this. This is a 20 years in the making deal and the IFA have never been for it and neither have...
But it's not just yet.
The IFA. Like, there's a lot of... Yeah, and it isn't. And as you said, Brexit is the main problem. Like, if when this is introduced, if it comes into play within the 8 years and Brexit goes through in October, we mightn't be talking about this at all because it mightn't be an issue. You mentioned, though, that the tonnage, so the 99,000 tonnes of beef, so let's say in the last look at this Mercosur deal that was put forward, they were going to have differentiation in terms of the cuts that were allowed into the EU market. Yeah. So with this 99,000 tonnes, it's down from what the Mercosur countries wanted, but the fact is that they're not breaking it down. So they're going to send in the highest cuts. So it's 1%, but it could be up to 40% of the value in the European market. And if we look at our the European market for beef, like, and I think we have to go back to...
Which cuts? Do we send steak?
So they're going to send steak, you know what I mean, which is going to appear on the shelf beside our cuts of meat. And, you know what I mean, there is what will appear in the supermarket and it will be cheaper and the consumer will buy it, but this will also disappear into wholesale where it won't be identifiable as...
Into burgers, kind of thing.
Basically into the retail trade, into the wholesale trade, into restaurants. And, you know, some of the beef coming from these countries is not problematic, but the farmers would have specific issues with Brazilian beef. Like, 11 years ago, my now boss, Justin McCarthy, and my old colleague, Kevin Kinsella, and the president of IFA went to Brazil and identified severe problems in relation to foot and mouth disease. Severe problems. And the EU, we take in a huge amount of meat from Brazil at the moment, you know what I mean? And they pay the tariff on it, and that's what's going. But the difficulty then, like, you know what I mean, that IFA, I suppose, and that's why IFA is probably in the heading, like, they've been talking about this for 13 years, do you know what I mean? Yeah. The difficulties. And then... only 2 years ago, there was a massive problem where the Brazilian authorities actually identified fraud within their own factories, which caused huge problems. So to say that, and I know that the commissioner has said it's going to be environmentally friendly, it's going to be this, it's going to be that, but they haven't proven themselves to the European Union in the past to be able to meet all these stipulations.
But would it not be more to box clever to raise issues about climate and our approach to it and the Paris Accords and all of that, and that's what
Minister Creed has said he's going to do that, you know what I mean, he's going to shadow box basically on some of these issues. But at the end of the day, you know what I mean, this has been agreed and they say that they're going to sign up to the Paris Accord and all the rest of it. But like I wrote it in my editorial last week, like the Brazilians cut down more rainforests last year than they did for the previous 10 years with him in charge, Bolsonaro.
But I think the key question here, or the key thing to recognise, is that this is about far, far more than beef. the according to the Sunday Times editorial, it says it took 20 years of negotiation, but less than 20 minutes to discuss, to dismiss it, and talking about the Irish Farmers Association focusing, as they're perfectly entitled to do, perfectly legitimate, the beef farmers to focus on that.
Yeah.
But this is about much, much more than this. In many respects, in a very volatile and slightly dangerous world of trade at the moment internationally, where we've got China and the US yeah. involved in, you know, in threatening each other with world trade wars, which could affect all of us, the EU is seeking to break through and to diminish its dependence on the US by opening up this huge market in South America for all sorts of goods, which include cars, which include pharmaceuticals, which include many, many things which are cars aren't manufactured in Ireland, but are manufactured in Ireland. And in terms of the recognition, and it's there in all the coverage today, that this is not simply about beef. Beef is a very small part of this entire trade deal, and we should be looking at the wider interest of Ireland and the EU, which may go well beyond beef.
Yeah. Mary?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it that to have concluded an agreement after 20 years is a big step forward. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't look very carefully at our little part of that huge agreement and challenge some of the figures that have been put out there on both sides, I think, both on the farming side, but also on the potential gains. And I would look forward very much to seeing this joint economic assessment that's going to be, independent economic assessment that's going to be carried out.
Environment as well.
Yeah, and I think there I've seen a figure that the minister said there would be a 4 billion gain to the Irish economy by 2030 from this agreement. Well, we should look at that very carefully, and they said it could be in three sectors, pharma, medical devices and the dairy sector. Now, on the other hand, the head of Ornua, which is, I think...
John Jordan.
Yeah, has said that there is no pot of gold there talking about dairy. So let's welcome it. Let's try to make it work. But, you know, we need to look very carefully about the details, and we won't have those details for a while. And when they do come out, by then, presumably, we will have this assessment. Right. In relation to the environment and the labour standards in the agreement, that's very welcome, but will it be enforced? Because in a lot of European agreements with third countries, there are provisions relating to human rights, and we haven't exactly been, you know, waving our flags on enforcing those. So, yes, it's welcome, but I'd like, again, and maybe we could push to ensure that those environmental standards are actually
right, because the stuff about the rainforest, forget about the beef.
Exactly.
Is utterly shocking.
It's not in our interest if these are not...
It's not in Europe's interest.
No.
Kieran? Yeah, sorry, we're a small, open, internationalised economy. I think everybody accepts that now. It used to be the case that I think back in the 60s, live cattle exports were the biggest exports and probably the only exports we had from this country. That's changed utterly now.
And we started off with protectionism.
Yeah, that's right. And the farming sector now is a much smaller part. It's an important part, I get that, but it's a much smaller part of our economy now than it's ever been. And we need to see the bigger picture here. And when you're part of the European Union... And, you know, there are bigger issues at play in these trade deals than beef exports. But I think it would be utterly ridiculous for Ireland as a country that parades itself to multinational companies as an internationalised, open economy, etc., to in some way try and scupper this deal because of the beef exports element of it. And I accept that's important for the farming sector, but, you know, there are bigger issues.
You see, the farming sector did so well initially out of the EU, and others, including the fishing people, now I don't want to start old wars, kind of figured that they were sold down the Swanee in the interest of getting a good deal for farmers. There have to be give and take.
Yeah, the farmers have done well out of being in the EU,
yeah.
But I think that's what separates food in terms of trade globally. Food is a different commodity. Food has the ability to start severe economic or unrest in countries. Like if you take what's happening in China at the moment with their African swine fever, and they're trying to hide the number of animals that have had to be slaughtered because... They don't want the political unrest. They have to import food. So food is a different commodity in terms of trade. And you mentioned trade, and like we do have, like Europe is at risk now with Trump. The USTR is trying to put retaliatory tariffs on food, even though it's to do with Boeing, and it's an Airbus war. It's nothing to do, aviation has nothing to do with food, but because it is where it will hit people, the president is picking food, Irish whiskey, cheese. And I suppose if you take the positives of the deal and what John Jordan is saying, you know what I mean? It is a very small quantity of what, like if you take it, let's say when Irish dairy was banned out of Russia back in 2013. We were exporting 250,000 tonnes, roughly. Yeah. This is 30,000 tonnes. You know what I mean? Yes, fine, it'll displace a little bit, but it's not a big market solution. And I think that, you know, fundamentally as well, we have to go back to the fact that in Europe, we put big demands on farmers. Consumers want everything. Do you know what I mean? And fundamentally, without, you know what I mean, there isn't a desire to pay for that. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And then, so, you know, it's all well and good and you tell the consumer, oh yeah, we've got all these rules and regulations on Brazil. And then a scandal happens and that product is gone. And we have nothing to replace it with because we've killed off our own industry.
Well, I'll come back to that in a moment. Fergus?
Well, I suppose I was going to say, first of all, that only on Irish radio would a discussion feature Irish whiskey as food, but leaving that aside, I mean...
That's how they live in the Oasis.
I understand. And a very good... I'm a great fan of Irish whiskey, don't get me wrong.
Comes from grain.
Never confuse it with food, really.
Food stuff.
It strikes me as... I just can't see... I'm really conflicted, because I think there is an awful lot to be said for a free trade agreement that covers 770 million people and that doubles the size potentially of, you know, the European population as a kind of free trade area. But I cannot see the merit of inviting the world's greatest leading, apart from Donald Trump maybe, climate change denier into the bosom of that agreement. It's not adequate for us to say we will have protocols about climate change and we'll have adequate protocols about human rights, because we all know that once the agreement is signed, that's the end of that. And President Bolsonaro is on record as saying, if not in so many words perhaps, that he'll tear the entire Amazonian rainforest down if he has to get more beef into the market.
Right.
Leave Irish farmers to one side. Forget Irish farmers entirely. That's not in the world's interest. It's not in the world's interest, certainly not in Europe's interest, that we should be signing up to an agreement which is going to encourage and facilitate more ruination of the Brazilian rainforest. It's just a recipe for complete disaster. And we're kidding ourselves if we think that we can sign an agreement, bind people to good behaviour, and they're going to honour it. It ain't going to happen.
Can I come back to beef here? Because, I mean, there's great pride in the fact that it's the lowest carbon footprint beef, allegedly, in the world, and, you know, it's grass-based and all of that, and that people are losing money on it. Why would you stay in a business that you're losing money on? Where is the money going?
Well, we had some would suggest the factory, some would suggest the supermarkets. The chain is broken in terms of the returns, and farmers are very frustrated. This year has been impossibly difficult for beef farmers in particular. Their incomes have fallen off a cliff. Costs have gone up.
I know that, but the farmers. I live in a farming community, etc. There's this habit if something looks promising, everybody goes into it. And then there's oversupply and there's a glut and the profit has gone south. Now, I know the commitment and the money and the work and the effort and the, you know, the stress of it all. But maybe we're overproducing beef ourselves.
Well, we have, we export 90% of our beef.
Yeah.
So from an Irish point of view, yes, we're...
But they're not making money.
But they're not making money at the moment. But at the same time, that is because consumers are not willing to pay enough, and the factories are not paying enough for the quality product that we're producing here.
So is their beef, if you pardon the awful pun, not with the factories?
There's considerable beef with the factories. We had a...
They seem to be very profitable.
Yep, and, you know, we had a feature in the paper this week about ABP and the profits, and that's going to go on for 3 weeks with our agribusiness editor.
Not just the profits, but also the taxes.
The lack of taxes that are being paid.
It's really not a coincidence that the farmers are doing so badly and Ireland's richest man is a beef processor. There must be some
well, relationship between one fact and the other. Well, we all know he was involved in beef for a very long time. But Kieran, you wanted to come in and then I'm going.
Yeah, I was going to make the point that the meat processors are doing very well out of this, and I was going to highlight the Larry Goodman case. There's been a lot of consolidation in that sector. But do you know what? Another thing, it also strikes me that the farmers are probably not very good negotiators because they're always giving out about the profit margins of the processors and the profit margins of the supermarkets on their goods. Yeah. So if they feel that much about it, then you know, why not negotiate a better price for themselves?
Have a chat with Larry.
Yeah, well, the industry has considerably consolidated, so there's not a whole lot of options about where farmers can go with their product anymore. They are reliant on the beef processors in the country to sell the product and get it out, which is why the beef processors are as equally worried about this Mercosur deal as the farmers.
But Brexit is a far bigger and more immediate threat.
Very much so.
Okay, going to have to leave it there. We have to take a break.